So we thought we'd start by sort of making some definitional proclamations, and each of us are going to talk about each of these things. So the first one we want to talk about is culture. And one of the things that we want to talk about, and this was, there are many definitions, but this was the one that I chose, because it talks about things that are learned and shared. And the question that we want to raise throughout this presentation is, where do we learn these things from? Who was teaching us? What were the motives behind what they were trying to teach us? And what did we do in terms of internalizing these things to transmit certain things to our children? Those of us who were not directly involved in the transatlantic slave trade, but were still under the influence of colonization, particularly on the African coast and other places, what were the vestigial things that were a part of how we had to manage the sort of schizophrenia that I referred to in the movie? So the things that we want to get to really are going to talk about this sort of intersection, and I hope that you find it interesting. Dr. Kittles.
All right, thanks. I'm happy to be a part of the panel, and I guess my charge today is to provide some level of an overview on genetics, just some definitions so that as we go further along, we're all on the same page. So when we talk about genetics and genetic background, genetic risk factors, what we're talking about is that inherited material that we all received from our mother and father. 50% of our DNA coming from our mother, 50% from our father, which is why your mother would say to you, "You look like your daddy," and you would say, "I hope so. I hope that's my daddy." But when we look at the genetic material that we inherit, it actually mixes, you know, so we're not all identical. And so thanks to the progress of the International Human Genome Project, we know sort of that there's 22 pairs of chromosomes and a sex chromosome, a pair of sex chromosomes that contain genetic material. And if we compare any two people in this room, you know, as I said, we're all unique, right? There is no sort of sharing of sort of this signature of your genetic makeup. It's like a fingerprint. And so we call these changes in the DNA polymorphisms. Poly means many, morph means forms. If we look at the sequence there at the top and compare in the room everybody's sequence, let's say, 94% of you guys may have a C there at the end, the second to last position, while maybe 6% may have a T. That's a SNP, a single nucleotide polymorphism. So I'm going to talk about those. There are literally millions of those in the genome. And so if we look across different human populations, what we find is that African populations have a lot more genetic diversity than non-African populations. And this is important as we go along and we start talking about, in particular, health disparities and risk for disease. African populations having a lot more because they've been around longer and they've been larger in population size. But I do want to raise the point here. When you look at that Venn diagram and those circles overlap, that means that we all share some common genetic linkages. We're all, you know, all people on the planet, we're all modern humans, right? Most of us. But if you look at that big circle for Africa, 50% of that variation in Africa is unique just to Africa. That's very, very important to understand. So when you look at some of these genetic studies and folks are, you know, they look at like 200 people from France or 50 people from Italy, they're not really capturing a lot of that genetic diversity. And so African Americans and also Hispanics have in this old gene pool, this very diverse old gene pool. And this is important as we go further along and we start talking about disparities, because race historically has been used to, you know, to group social demographic groups, right, that are used to measure these inequalities when we talk about disparities. But race is a crude proxy when we look at it in terms of the biomedical literature, in terms of risk, because race, what does it mean? What does it mean when you look through the literature and you can find, you know, thousands of papers if you go through PubMed where they say race predicts prostate cancer risk, African-American race? What does that mean? What does it mean when it says Hispanics have a higher risk for obesity or type 2 diabetes. What does that mean, that there's a Hispanic gene in terms of the risk factor, or is it chicken and watermelon? What is it, you know? When you use race, it confounds those risk factors, the biological and the environmental. And we all know that disease is very complex. So complex disease, multifactorial, reducing it just to race is going to be a problem. And that's what we've been doing historically in biomedical research. So what we do now is we tease apart those risk factors. We study the biology. We call that ancestry, genetic ancestry. I'm going to show you some data on that shortly. And then we measure the environment in a lot better ways. And so we're getting a lot better in measuring the environment. We're not there yet, but we understand that race is not going to be a useful proxy for those.
Just a quick reminder for those of you that just stepped in, there are a number of surveys that have been passed out as a part of this whole session. So if you wouldn't mind filling out the survey throughout the course of this presentation and then just pass and leave them at the, pass them to the front, to the end. That's right. Thank you.
Good afternoon again. My job is to really talk about this issue of environment and place. And there was a study that was done by the, I'm blocking on who did, but actually what they did is they looked at the city of Chicago, they looked at where people lived, and they did a comparison. And what they saw, and this has been done nationwide. Well, Steve Whitman's, that's local data. So it's Steve Whitman's data. But there's a lot of data that shows that where you live, and there people have actually documented it, they can determine your health status, your health outcome by your zip code. That's a predictor about your health status moving forward. On a personal level, and maybe I shouldn't divert to a personal level, growing up in Chicago, I grew up in a neighborhood on the south side of Chicago, and people from Chicago might know it. I grew up in Woodlawn. And my neighborhood has changed dramatically over the time. And so I'm not the best example of what comes out of Woodlawn. The house that I grew up in is now a vacant lot. The grammar school that I went to is a vacant lot. And the business that my parents owned for over 30 years is a block that's a vacant lot. So things happen in a neighborhood. And so your neighborhood can be a real predictor of your health status moving forward. So one of the things we're going to be talking about today, at least I'm going to be talking about specifically, are what are those things in terms of where you live, how you live, that actually impact upon your health moving forward. McGinnis did a study, and this is something a lot of people have probably looked at, that talks about the factors that actually influence health. And 40% of that, he predicts or he projects, are really behavioral choice. The choices that people make moving forward. I use this slide, and Dr. Mason used it for a number of years. It didn't occur to me till after maybe I'd used this slide for maybe 3 or 4 years that really the driving force was social circumstances and environment. Your choices are dictated by where you are and the options you have moving forward. So while behavioral choice might make up 40% of the factors that influence health, ultimately, it's an individual's social circumstances and their environmental conditions.
So I'm tasked to sort of look at two particular phenomena. One is trauma and the other is sickle cell disease. One you might think that has a pretty clear genetic situation, one that may not. So let's just take a look. And to actually quote and reference my colleague, Dr. Kittles, this whole issue of race, because the issue of race is a socio-economical political construct. It is not a biological construct, and that's what I think Dr. Kittles is saying. It is a construct that's been constructed by other people who would tend to use that in a negative way to try and make assertions about different things, and they're really proxies for some of the things that you've already heard discussed. And the fact of the matter is, as Dr. Kittles also showed in his Venn diagram, that if you look at the heterogeneity of the genome, the reason why one of the reasons why there's so much heterogeneity within the African genome is because the African genome is the father of all the genomes. It is the place where everybody in this planet, everybody that is walking on this planet, comes from that genome. And if there's a number of things you can look at that will support that. When we talk about trauma, just some definitional things about trauma, but I really want to call your attention to the second definition, the second part of this, where we talk about a disordered psychic or behavioral state, because that's what we really want to focus on, and we want to focus on not only that for the individual, but how that gets moved forward. So we look for a theoretical framework for this, and there was a great paper that you see quoted here that talks about this historical framework. This is actually out of the psychosocial literature, and there's three frameworks that we have to look at, and a lot of this is very consistent with the whole notion of place matters. But the psychosocial theory that talks about the things in your environment will also lead to your psychological stress. And we know now in the biochemical literature that there are increased catecholamines and other things that happen as a result of prolonged stress, intimal thickening in the arteries that lead to heart disease and things of that nature. In the political economic theory, which looks at the structural determinants of health, and particularly the unjust power relationships, those unjust power relationships, actually, if many of you saw the movie Unnatural Causes, in Unnatural Causes, there's this situation where the janitor, who has very little power over what happens to him, is contrasted to the CEO of that company, where he has as many stressors, but he has more power. So when this young man is being told to go and clean four rooms at the same time without any recourse to say anything about it, it creates a psychological stress, and he was suffering from hypertension, some other things. And then, of course, the last piece, the socio-ecological systems theory, and it looks at the things, these interdependencies that we're going to spend a lot more time talking about, those things that are happening right now, those things that have happened in the past, perhaps to your parents and grandparents, and talks about how those things may be related to what's going on today. There are four assumptions that also come out of this looking at trauma. And the first is mass trauma. And I'm going to show you in just a moment how all those come together in a very nice model that was also put together in this paper, which I don't see is referenced here, but there is a reference. I'll make sure that the reference gets on. It's on the other diagram. And then realizing that trauma, and I'm not just talking about physical, but I'm talking about emotional, psychosocial trauma, is not just limited to one bad thing. You have a lot of traumas that go on every single day, and these events can sort of what we call reverberate throughout an entire community. But the last assumption, which really, really is the one that is that caught my eye, is this whole notion of this being derailed. In other words, what would have happened if we had never had a transatlantic slave trade? What would have been different? How would we be different? How would America be different if the development was not arrested of our people by this particular situation? So we need to think about these, and we're just really trying to scratch the surface, and because much more about what we're learning about public health, which we've tried to almost reduce in many instances to the medicalization of these things, because we can look for a drug, we can look for a clinic, or we can look for those kinds of things. But the real issue that we have to deal with here is our psychological trauma, which has not been appropriately addressed. So these three constructs that we're going to talk just a little bit about, the historical experience, the response, and then the intergenerational transmission of the trauma, which is something that has been painful. I've been through a lot of groups, and we as a nation, but particularly as black people, we don't even want to talk about this. It's painful. We like to sweep it under the rug. We don't want to bring it out. It's not an uncomfortable thing when you have mixed audiences to talk about. But if we're going to move forward as a nation, if we're going to move forward as a healing people, we have to have the conversations in a truth way. So this conceptual model really, in my mind, lays it out as best as any that I've ever seen in the same paper. And this particular model really puts all of these things together. So if you look at the mass trauma experience usually put forth by the dominant group, which relates to the subjugation of a population and those four things that they talk about that happen as a result of it. Look at these things. See the history of the Pima Indian. See the history of the Cheyenne, of all of the Pontiac. See the history of all peoples who have been forced to live in this kind of subjugation. But the impacts of segregation and really displacement, in fact, in the same movie on the unnatural causes, when they looked for why the Pima Indians were having such high death rates from diabetes, and they spent $225 million looking for some genetic, looking for some sort of other medicalized reason for why it was happening, what they had to come to the conclusion was, and it was said by the same person, that in every instance when you have things like this, you have at the core of it people who have been ripped from their land, from their culture, from their own identity. And that trauma is what is leading to what we see. And I can show you that in the model. So if you look at the physical and psychological violence, and we've not talked about what's happened during that whole slavery experience, including some of the most public murders that used to happen that were called lynchings, where people were made to watch, children were made to watch their parents be lynched. In a book by Mr. Ralph Ginsberg called 100 Years of Lynching, which were nothing more than a series of newspaper accounts of lynchings that took place in America and reported on by various newspapers at that time, the whole notion that a child would have to sit there and look at his father being beaten to death till his eye fell out of the socket and then had a corkscrew drilled into his skin and pulled out quivering pieces of skin and looked at how each finger and every toe was cut off and passed out as a souvenir, while women cheered and men cheered. And we haven't talked about what that kind of trauma has done to that child and what that does to his children and his children. So as we look at these things and the economic situation that happened in this country, which the whole after the notion of emancipation, the whole notion of what happened with sharecropping and changing the economic model so that no matter how much you worked, you were always still economically disenfranchised. And of course, the cultural depression or disposition that happened, the standard that the Eurocentric standard became the standard for beauty. And so our children were then trying to bleach their skin and bleach their hair and straighten their hair and use caustic lyes to break the disulfide bonds in their hair so that it would... No, I'm just telling you the truth. Because this is what happened, but we don't talk about what does that mean at a molecular level and at a societal level, because even today we still see this as a beauty standard, which means that if everything that I see that is beautiful does not look like me, then what does that say about me? And that's why Keira Davis in 2005, when she redid the study of Kenneth Clark's experiment that helped desegregate the schools, we still had children in 2005 still seeing themselves as ugly, still picking white dolls over black dolls. And I'm just trying to show you that if that were reversed, if a white child would come home and want to darken their skin and kink their hair and begin to figure out how to inject their lips to change their features, then you would see a different kind of visceral reaction from the people that we're talking about. So that traumatic experience, that first generation of experience, which has gone on for several years and hundreds of years in this country, the response to that trauma, Dr. Satcher said it best, that predictive factors are not, he said something about having the what did I just do? Oh, that's not me, okay. I just put something down, the lights went out. I'm like, okay, what's going on in here? But there are resiliency factors. And when we talk about the issues of health disparities exist for one reason, because they're supposed to. There is no way that you can look at the historical the history of our people in this country and come to any other logical conclusion other than there should be some difference, because we've been different since we've been here. But it's really a story of amazing resilience. That's what it is. It's a real positive story. It's a story that of people who have had almost everything taken from them, including the identity of ourselves. Despite all of that, we're still here. So I'm going to begin to quickly give a few examples, and then I'm going to sit down. This is from a great book by Gabriel Schwab called Haunting Legacies. In this particular one, she talks about these different types of trauma and the issues of identity. So she talks about this particular gentleman, N. Scott Mamede, who is an I hate to use the word Native American or American Indian because it's just not correct. But he was a member of a particular tribe, of the Kiowa tribe. And when he was asked to talk about that, he couldn't. And he was actually embarrassed that he didn't know what it meant to be a Kiowa person. And that's because he had been totally educated in an Anglo-American environment. And he had to go back into those environments to find out what he was supposed to be like and how he was supposed to react. Frantz Fanon, many of you know from reading him a long time ago, this is my last one of these to talk about, but he said it best. He says, "No, Helfrich, I am a white man, for unconsciously I distrust what is black in me. That is the whole of my being." He goes on to talk about that he has these real conflicted problems. You know, that's that schizophrenia that we referenced early on, because we have to live in two worlds at the same time. We have to, and those many of you in the room shaking your head because you know exactly what I'm talking about. But we have to live in two worlds in order to be able to do the things that we need to do. But what he does, he talks about the traces of his feeling in both his affects and affective dispositions of his own self-image, because at his very core, he was, this is what we talked about before in terms of being interrupted. He was forever unable to feel what he could have been on his own terms as a colonized black man, because his ego ideal, his very core of the way he looked at himself, was as his colonizer looked at him. So this particular one of these last statements, when he talks about, "I'm a white man," but they also emulate the white man's rejection of being black. So the internal struggle that when you looked at the dials, when you look at Keira Davis's movie and looked at what was behind the people choosing these dials, the one little girl, when she was asked, "Which one are you?" She grabbed the white doll and she got ready to push out the white doll, and then she had to pull it back. She turns her head and pushes out the black doll. That's the embodiment of what we're talking about here. And he talked about in the book White Mask. He said that the difference is that you can't take the mask off. So this whole struggle, which many of us have had to deal with, has been a real issue. So let's talk now, shift to something a little bit more comfortable, I guess, to talk about. Malaria and sickle cell. It's right up Rick's alley here. So basically what I want to make the point is that, you know, we heard about sickle cell like it was something new, but I just put this slide here to show that it's been going on for a long, long time. And actually the Italian word for malaria, it means bad air. So you can see that over 4,000 years ago, this has been going on. Now, why is it important to me to talk about the 4,000 years? Because it takes time for these genetic adaptations, Rick, to happen. Is that right? And so we see that this is more of the history, and this is some of the words that we used to use in the native languages to describe these things. But we know that sickle cell disease is a way to change the shape of the hemoglobin. As you can see here by the blue arrows, there are some of the cells that are sickle-shaped. They're shaped differently, and that's because when the malarial parasites, which would come from the biting of the mosquito, were injected into the body, these parasites would often destroy these cells, and so it could not destroy the sickled cells. And it was the actual trait, the sickle cell trait, that created the protection. And I'm going to show you in this very simple way of looking at it. Most people, these are both people with sickle cell trait, the normal hemoglobin being represented by an A, and the sickle cell sickle hemoglobin represented by the S. So you can see in these, in this situation, that there's a 25% chance for each child that one will be born with both normal hemoglobins, a 50% chance that they're going to have trait, and a 25% chance that they're going to have disease. It is sickle trait that was protective. As you can see here in this slide, that those that had hemoglobin AS had less death rates from sickle cell disease than those who had SS. So this modification happened as a result of the confluence of our genetics, the culture, the environment, which produces a way to protect ourselves. Much like what we're suffering with now, those of you in the public health area, which should be all of you, dealing with bed bug problems. At least we're dealing with bed bug problems. Why are we dealing with bed bug problems? Because we were using the pyrethrins to use to kill the bed bugs. And the bed bugs now have developed a genetic adaptation that allows their sodium channels not to respond to the pyrethrin like it used to, much like the roaches used to do. So that is why we have the problem. That's why conventional things are no longer killing them. Life always tries to find a way. Thank you.
Again, just a reminder that this is session 3418.0, and this is going to be a continuous presentation. We'll take questions at the end. Dr. Martin is collecting surveys that were passed out at the start of the session, and now Dr. Rickle.
Kittles. Yeah, so thanks a lot, Dr. Mason. Very interesting. Life always finds a way. So my talk is going to deal with the role of biology in the environment in cancer, mainly prostate and breast cancer. I study prostate cancer genetics at the University of Illinois, Chicago. And one of the things I guess I should start with is just saying that all cancer is genetic. But not all cancer is hereditary, meaning that there are some genetic changes that occur, whether they're inherited that you may have received from your parents or changes that occurred through the lifetime of the organism or of the human, that due to some exposure, be it diet or some environmental exposure, change the genetic makeup of cells somewhere in your body that leads to cancer. And so, as I mentioned earlier, with the advent of the Human Genome Project, we now have a lot of useful information on where in the genome these, what we call susceptibility genes are, these predisposing genes for risk for cancer, be it colon, prostate, or breast. But having these particular polymorphisms or these mutations in these genes doesn't necessarily mean that you will get prostate or colon or breast cancer. What it does suggest is that there is a complex interaction. While we're more than just our genes, these genes do not operate in a vacuum. So think about it like this. We have these genes in every cell of our body except for the red blood cell, but they interact with other genes. And they also interact with the environment, be it in the cellular level or the tissue level or even at the level outside of the body in terms of the intake of diet or as I mentioned before, other exposures. And so we have to think about it we have to think beyond just the DNA sequence. And so when we talk about cancer genes, they're the high penetrant, and then there's the common, what we call low penetrant genes. So for instance, BRCA1 and 2, the breast cancer gene, those are high penetrant, meaning that if you have those mutations, more than likely, very, very high a percentage of the time, you will end up getting a breast cancer. And so these are what we call where the absolute risk is high, the frequency of these variants, though, are low. And you find them really in select families. They're sort of inherited in select families. You don't find them common across the population or in high frequency across the population. So when you look at the attributable risk, it's low for those. And we use families to find those. Then there's the low penetrant, or the common low penetrant, where the risk is low. The frequency of the variants are high, meaning everybody pretty much carries at least one copy of these low penetrant alleles. And you need to have many of them in order to end up getting the cancer phenotype. And so, as I mentioned earlier, we talk about disease, in particular disparate diseases. We talk about the social influence. I'm going to use race in that context as a social, cultural context. But ancestry is what I'm talking about when I'm talking genetics. Okay, so African Americans have a shared ancestry of from West Africa. Okay, shared genetic ancestry, meaning if you look at it, there's shared common genetic background because we share a historical history as a population. So when we talk about prostate cancer, one of the most frequently diagnosed cancers among men, widely considered to be slow-growing and relatively benign cancer, but it is the second leading cause of deaths among men. And a very interesting study, autopsy study out of Detroit, found that 30% of men in their 30s, 60% of men in their 60s, 70% of men in their 70s actually have prostate cancer. So the older you get, you will end up getting it, unless you're a female. So females are like, wait a minute, I'm not getting that. You're absolutely right. You don't have a prostate. It's only men, okay? We'll get to you in a second. But slow growing, right, for the most part. But the question is, what is it about these tumors that differ molecularly that will allow us to say this person is probably going to die from this versus this person is not going to die from it. He'll probably end up getting some cardiac arrest or hit by a bus or something like that. But we need to know. I mean, that's the million-dollar question, isn't it? Being able to do a biopsy, diagnose cancer, and be able to say this is one of those aggressive ones. Because right now we really don't have that sort of information. And that's where the molecular genetics is going to come play a role. Some of the risk factors for prostate cancer, positive family history, the strongest risk factor. If you have a first-degree relative, you can have a very elevated, highly elevated risk. It can go from 2 actually to 20-fold increased risk, depending on the number of first-degree relatives, and especially if it's earlier age of onset. Now, there have been some genes identified that are involved in hereditary and sporadic prostate cancer, but we're still trying to tease out sort of what the effects of these genes are. So there have been some interesting studies, and our group has found some of these genes, but we still don't know exactly the role that they're playing, unlike BRCA1 and 2 for breast cancer. Now, when we look at the dietary risk factors, they include something like total fat intake, animal fat intake, and consumption of red meat. Now, I'm about to say something that some of you might get a little uneasy about, but, you know, one of the biggest dietary risk factors is burnt red meat. The consumption of overcooked red meat. Yes, and you know how we like to barbecue and all that stuff, charbroil, all that. Elevated heating or cooking your meat at elevated temperatures actually increases the amount of FIPS, which create DNA adducts and DNA damage. It's a risk factor for not only prostate, but also colon cancer. And so that alone can account for some of the disparities that we see in terms of prostate and colon cancer across different populations who have different dietary traditions. So behavior risk factors include smoking. While smoking doesn't increase your risk for prostate cancer, it does increase your risk for aggressive prostate cancer, meaning if you have prostate cancer and you're a smoker, you're at a higher risk for getting aggressive prostate cancer. And our group and many others have shown this. In fact, it can go up to 2-3-fold higher risk for aggressive prostate cancer among smokers. Dietary components include antioxidants, lycopene, and there's some debate on that, vitamins A, D, and E, and selenium, also kind of controversial. But I don't really like lycopene, so, you know. Thank you. Right. Well, thank you for that information. Now I know. when you look at the incidence of prostate cancer, this is per 100,000 men. You see that African Americans have the highest incidence, actually in the world, and mortality also follows this pattern. much higher among African Americans than European Americans and Asian Americans. So what is it that accounts for that difference there in incidence? That's what the disparity that we're talking about. We see the same thing when we look at these precursor lesions in the prostate, be it high-grade or low-grade PIN or prostatic intraepithelial neoplasia. These lesions also, we see elevated incidence or prevalence among African Americans compared to whites. So I want to talk about sort of this, the issue of how race has been used and this issue of race-specific PSA. Now, I'm sure we're all familiar with PSA. There was a task force. I call them the group of blind men. They might have been a woman in there, too. they got together and said that we're doing too much PSA testing. We're over-screening, and so we're over-treating men with prostate cancer. I'm sure most of you in the room know that I have I take issue to that, because in the African American population, in the community that I live on the South Side, similar to Joe, when we go out and screen, we find a large percentage of men who have never been screened before for prostate cancer in their 60s. And so much so, in some cases, it's like 20% of the men that we screen have never had a PSA test. So until we can resolve that, I don't want to hear any sort of discussion about we're over screening, because there are communities across the United States that screening is just not being done routinely. So another reason why the PSA is controversial is because many urologists believe that there are differences. PSA, the biomarker that for the test for prostate cancer, actually behaves differently in whites versus blacks. If you look through the literature, you see that African Americans appear to have elevated PSA levels compared to whites. And so what we wanted to do was, let's see, why don't we use ancestry to tease apart that issue of race to see if it's a genetic component to that difference in PSA. And so what we did was, we got together with a group at Fox Chase who had a large cohort of men who were at risk for prostate cancer. This was a screening cohort, men who self-reported as white and men who self-reported as black. And so we looked at the predictability of PSA. You see there, for a PSA cutoff of 4.0, the predictability in whites was 38%. For the same cutoff in African Americans, the predictability was about 62%. So, in fact, there was some differences there just based on self-report. Now, if we then said, okay, well, let's look at those African Americans, because we know African Americans, are very genetically diverse. We go from Halle Berry to Wesley Snipes and everybody in between. Vanessa Williams and Wesley Snipes and everybody in between. All right? So. So genetically, there is enormous heterogeneity there. And so because of the one-drop rule, or the rule of hypodescent, we consider ourselves African-American if we have one ancestor who's black. I mean, I'm not going to get into that social legislation, but that rule created so much diversity in the African-American population, and which also creates a lot of fuzziness in genetic studies on African-Americans if you don't take that into account. So here we have a situation where we have a group of men who self-reported as African-American, genetically could be anywhere in that spectrum of African, West African to European ancestry, and you see a lot of a difference there in prediction between whites. So then what we did was we typed these ancestry informative markers and stratified the African-Americans based on low tertile 1, medium tertile 2, to high levels of West African ancestry, tertile 3. And what we did was we saw that the prediction for prostate cancer actually differed across those tertiles. In fact, the prediction for those who had high levels of West African ancestry was much higher than the prediction of low levels. So genetically, in terms of shared genetic ancestry, there was some component there that actually was correlated with differences in PSA predictability. And so now we're going in and trying to understand what that ancestral component means. Is it a set of genes, or is it some genes, or is it some genes in the environment that's actually improving the predictability there of the biomarker? And so that's where things are going now. So when we talk about breast cancer, also there's the genetic, hormonal, environmental, dietary risk factors. We know BRCA1 and 2, 1994, they were cloned, those two genes. And allow a woman to know, in fact, if she's at elevated risk. women who have a family history, a first-degree relative, they're normally told to get the BRCA1 and 2 test. The problem, though, is if you go, if you're an African American or Hispanic and you get the BRCA1 or 2 test, they'll send it to the lab and it'll come back and it'll say most of the time undetermined, unknown. You'll have a series of polymorphisms in that gene or mutations in the gene, but they haven't been characterized. And so you've just wasted $10,000. And the reason why it was not characterized, because we don't know a lot about the polymorphisms in that gene, in those two genes, in African descent women. Now, you would think that by now we would have a large enough data set so that we can say all of these, this is the spectrum of mutations in this gene among people of African descent. But we're still years away from that. And so that's where the technology isn't necessarily beneficial or equitable across all populations. You guys see what I'm saying? We have this technology that's very informative, but it's informative only for certain groups. And so this is why I think genetic medicine and personalized medicine may actually increase health disparities if it isn't equitably distributed. So we look at the risk factors for breast cancer. If you have those mutations, you can increase your risk up to 14-fold. But listen, this is only 10% of breast cancers. This is the familial, the hereditary breast cancer. Most of breast cancer is sporadic, and that's due to those low penetrant common variants that are in the population and also their interaction with the environment. When you think about the hormonal factors, age in which, at menarche, menopause, number of children, all of those impact risk for breast cancer. So real quickly, I'm going to go to this study where we looked at breast cancer in African Americans, European Americans, and Hispanic Americans. This is part of the breast cancer care study in Chicago, where we had over about 1,000 women who were diagnosed with breast cancer from 2005 to 2008. I wanted to do this study because we kept hearing so much about triple negative, you know, the hormone receptor negative cancers being more aggressive and more common among women of African descent. So I said, well, if that's the case, and if it's biological, then it should be correlated with genetic ancestry. If not, then more than likely it's environmental. And so when we looked at these three populations, so the histogram at the top left is the proportion of European ancestry among whites. The second one up top is the proportion of European ancestry among blacks, and then to the right are the Hispanics. And you'll notice that the distribution of European ancestry among whites, the bulk of them have, am I saying this right? Yes, the bulk of them have, you know, high levels of European ancestry. There was no association with grade, stage, or receptor, except for if you had higher levels of European ancestry and you were a white woman, you more than likely had receptor positive cancer. Okay, there was a correlation with European ancestry in that. Among the African Americans, women, we found that African ancestry, West African ancestry, was correlated with higher grade and stage among individuals with high levels of West African ancestry. That's what you see at the bottom there in the middle. The red line and the green line, they're both significant, showing a correlation with grade and stage of breast cancer, but not hormone receptor status. So the triple negative, which is found among African Americans, but it's also found in whites too. All right, so it's not something that's endemic sort of to African ancestry. And I think it's something that sort of says something about the management of the disease through time. Because it's not like these women just all of a sudden have triple negative, a hormone receptor negative cancer. This is something that occurs as the cancer continues to grow and it's unmanaged, lack of access and all of that. So these are things that we need to really look at in how genetics is playing a role with the environment. Well, let's talk about the environment real quick. Well, we know the likelihood of being diagnosed with stage 3 or 4 breast cancer versus stage 1 is much higher for the uninsured and those on Medicaid. That's real. You know, it has nothing to do with genes. That's across the board. And so if you complicate that with risk, genetic risk, you can see sort of the impact that could occur. Now, race and ethnicity affects access and high-quality treatment also. We find that the odds ratio of receiving inappropriate treatment is much higher among Native Americans and African Americans and Hispanics compared to whites. So I think that this is also something that's well-characterized in the literature and we also have to recognize. So where do we go from here? We need to explore risk across multiple populations. We need to shift our expectations, given the heterogeneity of prostate and breast cancer. Those are very heterogeneous cancers, very complex cancers. And so those tumors are found throughout the tissue. And as I said before, there really isn't a clear molecular signal as of yet where we can say this person is actually going to die from, let's say, prostate cancer. Both are hormonal-related cancers, and thus dietary factors are important. But I guess the bottom line here is when we talk about genetics, we need to prioritize which cancer disparities have strong genetic influences. I think prostate is one of them, where genes are playing a very strong role that are accounting, that could account for some of the disparities. But many of the other cancers aren't. The genetics isn't really the major predictor there. So we need to study the etiology and the effect of the environment and develop interventions. So we have to be honest with the fact. Dr. Mason mentioned earlier, $250 million later with the Pima, you know, it was, you know, all of a sudden you threw your hands up and said, oh, there's nothing there. You know, I mean, we have to be honest about that up front. You know, and when it is the environment, then we put the money into interventions in the environment. So part of doing that, one way of doing that, is increasing transdisciplinary research. So equitable benefits from genetic medicine depend on many things. Population genetics, which, remember I said, the allele frequencies vary across different populations. It also depends on market economics, because this is bucks. This is real. You know, when we're in the academy, we don't think about business, but this is big business. Healthcare is big business. You see, it's pretty much shut the government down because of healthcare. Okay? So think about in terms of genetic medicine being a pathway to improving health in a capitalistic society. Of course, market economics is going to be quite important. Most importantly, on historical and cultural identities, there is a context in which these diseases are operating in, a local context that I think we have to think about and not just group everything together, all African Americans or all Hispanics. And then inclusion means paying attention to context, social, cultural, and historical. Thanks.
Again, this is session 3418.0, and our final presenter will take questions at the end. This session goes until 6 o'clock, so we should have about 15 minutes for questions at the end.
I'm going to start off with a quote that Terry was working on. It's Dr. Satcher's quote, and I think it applies to a lot of people in this room. And Dr. Satcher has been famously known for saying, risk factors are not predictive factors because of protective factors. And so a lot of us in this room had a lot of risk factors, but there were also protective factors in our lives that allowed us to be where we are today. So my discussion is around the role of biology and the environment in hypertension. I'm not a physician. I'm not a geneticist. So mine is probably going to be the least scientific presentation, but I do have a lot of data to put out there. But the first thing I want to do is just give people a little idea of what hypertension is and what diabetes is. Hypertension is a sustained elevation of blood pressure. So it's not unusual for blood pressure to go up typically in the course of a day. But once the blood pressure goes up and remains high, that's what's called high blood pressure or hypertension. There are five causes of hypertension, and these are biologic. It's based upon the volume of blood, the viscosity, the thickness of blood, cardiac output, the elasticity of the arterial walls, and peripheral vascular resistance. A change in any one of those five things will change blood pressure. And usually when they're talking about medicines to treat hypertension, that's what the medicines do. They make an adjustment for those. Now, diabetes, on the other hand, is a metabolic disease in which a person has high blood sugar, either because the body does not produce enough insulin or the cells do not respond to the insulin that's being produced. So that's simply what diabetes is. Now, they have some common risk factors, and these are the five risk factors they have in common. Some of these we've already talked about, but there are these things that are non-modifiable. Can't change your family, can't change your race, can't change your age. So no matter what you do, those are things that are going to happen regardless of what you do. But there are some modifiable risk factors related both to hypertension and to diabetes. Lack of physical activity is one. Poor diet is another. This is a very interesting slide. It comes from a study that was done in 2005, and it looked at the actual, what's called the actual causes or the what really is driving what we see in terms of death in the United States. In 2005, there were about 2.5 million people that died. 49% of these deaths were among men. 96% of all deaths in the United States were in people 30 years of age or older, and half of those were in persons over 70 years of age. As you can see from this, the four most common causes of death were heart disease, lung cancer, stroke, and chronic obstructive pulmonary disease. Tobacco smoking is still, and was still then, the number one preventable cause of death, with an estimated 467,000 deaths. But number two was high blood pressure, which a lot of people probably didn't realize. And each of those accounted for about one in five or one in six deaths in the United States in 2005. Obesity, overweight, physical activity, and high blood glucose each caused somewhere between 190,000 to 216,000 deaths. That's 8 to 9% of all the deaths in the United States during that period. Now, this is a slide that looks at what it cost us in terms of the 20 leading diagnoses for direct health care expenditure in the United States. And you could see that of the 20, that hypertension and diabetes rank in the top 10. So again, we're talking about things that are very serious and things that we need to be concerned about. This looks at the age-adjusted prevalence for high blood pressure in adults 20 years of age by race, sex, and ethnicity. And interestingly enough, the group that has the highest level of blood pressure is non-Hispanic black women. So when you look at it, must hit the same. Followed by non-Hispanic black men. And it shows in the different year quadrants. When you look at the extent of awareness, treatment, and control of high blood pressure by race and ethnicity, again, the groups that really are the highest in terms of awareness, treatment, and control are non-Hispanic black females, which is really interesting because I think that we know we have problems, but we always don't take care of the problem. So knowing you have a problem and actually doing something about the problem is an entirely different thing. This is the age-adjusted prevalence of physician-diagnosed diabetes mellitus in adults age 20 and over. And again, as you can see, the highest prevalence of diabetes, which comes as no surprise, I'm sure, to people in this room, are African-Americans and Hispanics, and this is specifically Mexican-Americans. African-Americans and Mexicans have the highest prevalence of diabetes. And this, again, looks at the age-adjusted prevalence of physician-diagnosed type 2 diabetes in adults 20 years of age and older. And again, you see the same trend moving forward, but it looks at education as well. And you see the people that have typically, with some exception, the highest rates of diabetes are the people that have the less education, except for non-Hispanic black men. And for some reason, men with a high school education have a higher rate of diabetes than men with less than a high school, but not by much. This is diabetes awareness, treatment, and control, and this doesn't break it down by race, but what it does show you is that when we're looking at the population, there's only 43.2% of the people with diabetes that actually have their diabetes effectively controlled. The rest of the group, either their diabetes is not controlled, is not treated, and there are many people that are not even aware of the fact that they have diabetes. This is some local data. This is from the city of Chicago. And this helps to make the point very dramatically. This looks at heart disease mortality rate. And it also is a map of the major racial and ethnic groups in these areas. And if you look at the highest rates of heart disease mortality in the city of Chicago, that every community that has a high heart disease rate, except for one, New City, is majority African American. There's no white majority community except Beverly and Morgan and Mount Greenwood, people that know Chicago, that has a heart disease rate over the city total. So the largest impact relative to heart disease, again, is African Americans, and this map dramatically shows what that's like. This is a map looking at diabetes mortality. And again, you see the same kind of trend, that the neighborhoods with the highest rates of diabetes tend to be majority African American or Hispanic. So predominantly minority areas of the city of Chicago have the highest rates, both of, the highest death rate from diabetes and the highest death rate from cardiovascular disease. Now, what is driving some of this? And these are just a couple of slides that I threw in. One, and just for the sake of it, there's been a lot of talk about sugar-sweetened beverage, and this looks at the increase in the U.S. consumption of sugar-sweetened beverages over time. This looks at the amount and total U.S. expenditures of food eaten away from home, because now we eat out more than we eat in and more than we prepare food. And so I'm going to talk about two things, food access, and then I'm going to get to just a short series of slides to talk about this issue of prevention, and lastly, the social determinants of health. Mari Gallagher did a study and a report in the city of Chicago about food deserts. And food deserts, it was really interesting at the start in Chicago, but I think everybody in the nation has heard about food deserts at this point. And this is her slide that defines what a food desert is. And how many people have food deserts in the area where they live? Okay, so most of you are familiar. These are areas that are clustered that have no or distant grocery stores, and a relationship between access, it's trying to make the relationship between access to healthy food, health outcome, and having access to healthy food. Essentially what she found, and Steve Whitman did a study that found the same thing, that African Americans in Chicago by far must travel the greatest distance to a grocery store. And there's no racial or ethnic group in the city that have closer access to grocery stores, and we have greater access to fast food locations than we do to grocery stores and healthy foods. And this comes from a report done by the Food Trust that actually looked at the issue of income and diet-related deaths in Chicago. And if you look at the map of income and diet-related deaths and you compare it to the map of food deserts, you see that it's the same neighborhoods that are being impacted by this issue. And these are predominantly African American, and actually they're in Hispanic communities they don't have food deserts, because it gets back to Terry's issue of culture. There's a different culture, and there's a different approach to food and the foods that people eat. Now, this is looking at I assume most people here are familiar with the Behavioral Risk Factor Surveillance Survey. This is data from 2009 in Illinois, looking at how physically active people are now. And 70% of people report that the type of work they do involves mostly sitting or standing. So we've actually removed all physical activity from the work that people do. And when asked did people get any exercise, 76% said yes, 24% said no. But when you look at the prevalence of people meeting the 2008 Federal physical activity guidelines among U.S. adults by race and ethnicity, what you'll see is that the highest group is non-Hispanic white, followed by non-Hispanic black, and followed by Hispanic. So non-Hispanic blacks and Hispanics are less likely, both male and female, to engage in physical activity. But I want to get back to this issue of place, and place matters, that there are issues that drive where people can actually get out and engage in physical activity. If you live in a neighborhood where there is not a park or a place to go to be active, that's one. But also if you live in a neighborhood that's violence prone, then you're less likely to be physically active and get out and engage in physical activity. So this takes me back to something that I talked about in an earlier slide, and they do attribute 40% of the factors that influence health to behavioral choice. But again, it's your social conditions, your social circumstances, and environmental conditions that actually drive the choices or determine the choices that you have. This is a slide on disease prevention, and it talks about prevention from the standpoint of how you prevent and how you can prevent risk factors moving forward. This is nothing new. It's something that's been very old. It's something that goes back to ancient Africa and Egypt. Disease prevention is not a new concept. And what I really want to get to is this idea of primordial prevention, which perhaps some people in this room have not heard of. Anybody heard of primordial prevention? Primordial prevention is a term used by cardiologists, and it really focuses on the prevention of risk factors. How do you prevent a risk factor from actually occurring? It's a relatively new concept. It really focuses on preventing risk factors from occurring in the first place. Some examples of primordial prevention are national policies and programs on nutrition, involving the agricultural sector, comprehensive policies to discourage smoking, and we've seen that those have been successful. Programs to promote regular physical activity. But I really want to end with a brief discussion of the social determinants of health. This essentially gets back to this issue of place matters. And this is a slide that I worked on with Dr. Mason when he was Commissioner of Health. And what we came to conclusion is where we live, how we live, what we eat, what we do determines how we die. The social determinants of health are the conditions in which people are born, grow, live, work, and age, including the health system. They're shaped primarily by the distribution of money, power, resources at a global, national, and local levels, which are in themselves influenced by policy choices, not by us, by policy choices. And they're responsible in large part for a lot of the inequities that we see moving forward. This is from a report done by the World Health Organization called Closing the Gap in a Generation. Again, it deals with the same thing, the unequal distribution of power, income, goods, and services globally and nationally, and unfairness in the immediate visible circumstance of people's lives. And they offer up, and I'm going to skip that, they offer up three steps to improve those conditions. One, improve the conditions of daily life. Two, tackle the inequitable distribution of power, money, and resources. And three, measure the problem, develop an evaluation, evaluate action, expand a knowledge base, and develop a workforce. Thank you. And I'm turning it back to Dr. Mason.